Hi, Sue Hall here, and welcome to the 12th podcast in our fourth series of Talking the Dis Out of Dyslexia, hosted by the Whole Dyslexic Society. On March 27th, 2021, TEDx Bear Creek Park live streamed 12 talks, and I was privileged to be one of the speakers. Today, Carly Phillips joins us from the University of Victoria. She is a researcher in residence on the Wildfire and Carbon Project. Carly, welcome.
Sue, thanks for having me.
Your TEDx was called The Language of Climate Change, and it was full of really interesting information, but it came from this unique perspective, because I think a lot of people, when they hear climate change, they automatically go to Greta Thunberg now. And she has lots of interesting facts and information, obviously, and she's very emotive, but you came at it from a slightly different angle. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I came at it from a language perspective. So thinking about the way that words and the words that we use to describe certain phenomena shape the way that we think about them. So I specifically, like you mentioned in your introduction, study wildfires and their implications for climate. And wildfires are really interesting in that they are an impact of climate change, right? We know that higher temperatures, longer droughts, all of that are increasing the likelihood of severe and catastrophic wildfires. But at the same time, the wildfires themselves are releasing huge amounts of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. So there's this interesting give and take. And what I found in my work is that the way that we talk about that and the way that we describe that is so important for helping people understand what's at risk, but also what we can do about it. And so I wanted to capture that language piece because I think that sometimes the science of it can seem esoteric and there's not a lot to grab onto, where I think with the language piece and thinking about the intersection of climate change and language, it gives us a place to really sink our teeth in and think about these issues from a different perspective.
Make it part of our world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Carly, I'm being very ignorant here, but wildfires seem to be a bad thing. This is what you're saying, right? But at the same time, there's
prescribed burning.
Yeah. How does that balance out?
Well, it's interesting to hear you describe wildfires as bad, right? Because that's, I think, the language piece in terms of how we've interacted with wildfires in the past and what our cultural understanding is. So from a science perspective, I would say that wildfires are pretty agnostic. They're neither good nor bad. In certain ecosystems, they occur naturally. In certain forests here in BC, wildfires happened every couple of decades, but they didn't necessarily look like the wildfires that we have now. In some ecosystems, particularly, we've seen it a lot in the Western US, the fires in California, some of those ecosystems were used to fires that were surface fires. They would just go along the forest floor, clear out the underbrush, any dead fuels that were down, but didn't have the catastrophic consequences. They didn't reach to the canopy in the same way that other fires did. So in that sense, those fires are also not good or bad. They're just part of the ecological processes. But I think what we've gotten to now in terms of our understanding of wildfire is that we've disrupted our ecosystems to such an extent that wildfires are in some ways objectively bad when it comes to society. There's human life at risk, there's ecosystems at risk, there's property at risk, and it's not necessarily the fire regime that certain ecosystems evolved with. So it's interesting, though, the way that we put those words on concepts and phenomenon that may or may not deserve it, but reflect the change in our perception socially.
I think you're saying that the original wildfires were pretty much on the same sort of level as the prescribed fires. So they really didn't do so much damage, and perhaps they were good for the ecosystem. But now they're so huge that obviously they are not so useful.
Yes and no. Yeah, it depends a lot on the ecosystem. There are some ecosystems that I've worked in, like in the boreal forests in the far north, their fire regimes are high intensity crown fires. So big kind of what we think of as conflagrations, where the forest really goes up. Those are the fires that historically have happened in those ecosystems. So when those happen there, it's not necessarily a departure in the same way. Oh. It's really ecosystem dependent, which I think makes talking about fires generally really challenging.
Yeah. If the ecosystem has been used to this, then it's not such a threat. But if the ecosystem is sort of shocked into this bigger fire that you talk about, then it's not okay.
Sure. And I think that that's one of the things that's so critical about the fire situation now is human intervention. In this case, suppressing fires, keeping fires out of the system, are a huge part of why we're seeing these mega fires and giga fires now, because we've kind of homogenized the landscape. So everything's the same. It's similar age trees, that kind of thing. And there's no longer the patchiness that used to change the way that fire would flow.
And that brings me to the use of language that you were talking about, because one of the words that popped out for me was your use of conservation. And I love that you said it, conservation has always seemed to mean that we've been preserving something from the past, but now we're talking about what we need to put into our future.
Definitely. And I think there's this idea that humans weren't part of the natural system before, right? There was a before time where there weren't humans and there were these pristine, untouched environments. But what we know from the science is that's not true. We know that humans have been interacting and shaping their environment with fire for a really, really long time. And so the idea that there are those ecosystems that are untouched is kind of an artifact of colonization, basically, in terms of the way that we're conceptualizing, especially the North American West. And so I think that breaking down that barrier and changing, like you said, changing the language, changing what that means, will be really important for managing our ecosystems as climate change continues to worsen.
Absolutely. Are there any other words that you'd like to change the meaning of?
Well, I think there are a lot of words that are new because of climate change. And when I was working on my TED talk, I remember there were a lot of words I had to cut, right? We were constrained to a certain amount of time and you can't talk about everything that you want
to. Now's your
chance. One of those, exactly. Thank you, Sue. One of those for me was the word greenwashing, which has become really prominent in the kind of climate accountability circles. So greenwashing refers to corporations that are polluters, typically, trying to make some of their practices seem more sustainable and good for climate than they are. So we've seen things like these massive oil companies, Chevron, BP, come out and say that they're, you know, spending a fraction of their budget on climate mitigation or something like that, or even smaller companies that aren't fossil fuel companies trying to paint themselves as sustainable. You know, Amazon, for instance, saying that all of their trucks are going to go electric. That's great. I certainly agree that that's great and important progress, but I don't think it mitigates in any way the negative climate consequences that the activities of a corporation like Amazon have had.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a good word, greenwashing. I love that. It's like whitewashing, only it's green. Can you think of another one?
Some of the words that I wish were part of the broader conversation are words that we use to talk about how carbon moves. Words like flux, carbon sink, carbon stock, carbon source. Those words, I think, are particularly important as we're starting to have conversations around what we do about climate change. And I think having a real foundational understanding of those words is important in having that conversation. And one of the ways that this comes up in my work is through forests. Forests are stocks of carbon, right? You have the carbon that's in the trees, in the soil, that's stored there. And so that's a stock. But forests are also carbon sinks. In a lot of ways, right? They're taking carbon out of the atmosphere as the plants photosynthesize. And so they occupy this dual space. But I think when we're talking about forests, we're thinking about them as either or, and potentially conflating both. The stock that we have is much larger than any sink could pull down in a given year, but it's important to both preserve that stock and preserve that sink. So I think that there's some kind of conceptual underpinnings that are important to understand when it comes to carbon words and thinking about climate change more generally.
Okay, so carbon stock is larger than the carbon sink. Then doesn't that mean we're not in such a bad way as we think we are?
I think that's for forests. So in thinking about that one specific ecosystem, forests generally are thought of as sinks, like you said, which is great. And the power of forests, you know, kind of their photosynthetic capacity and ability to take carbon out of the atmosphere is one of the ways that governments are proposing we mitigate climate change. I think what's important to distinguish, though, is the stocks and the sinks from the natural environment and how they pale in comparison in many cases to the fossil fuel emissions of our societies. And so, yes, forests definitely can help mitigate climate change, but if we don't reduce fossil fuel use, it's not going to matter.
The forests are actually doing a pretty good job on their own, but we're messing it up with all the fossil fuel emissions.
Definitely. And one of the things that happens in wildfires is a lot of carbon that's part of those stocks is released back to the atmosphere. So when the forests burn, that carbon goes up into the atmosphere as greenhouse gases. And so they are not only a stock of carbon, a sink of carbon, but when it comes to wildfires, they can be a source of carbon as well.
Got you. Wow. Wow, this is so interesting. Thank you. So what words do we need in the future? What words do we really need to use to bring about a change in people's thinking?
I think we need the words accountability. There's lots of evidence that fossil fuel companies knew exactly what was happening and what was predicted to happen in the 1970s in terms of carbon dioxide concentrations in the environment, warming our world. Despite that knowledge, they were part of a campaign to sow doubt amongst the general populations so that their carbon emissions and their business model wouldn't be regulated. So I think that there's accountability in that sense, in holding those polluters accountable. But I also think there's an accountability to ourselves and to our children. I don't have children, but I have young people I care for. And I want their world to be livable. And I think that in that sense, we have to hold ourselves accountable as the generations that are able to take action right now, have an accountability that it is our responsibility, and that we can't just pass the buck to the next generation.
Absolutely. Carly, have you always been interested in forests as a child? Tell us about early Carly.
Oh, gosh. I have not always been interested in forests. I think I really surprised my family when I decided to become an ecologist, because they all had memories of me. If we were hiking as a family, I would sit down at the start of a trail and say, pick me up when you're done. And so in that sense, I think my ability to appreciate nature matured as I did. And my ability, to understand the importance of forests also grew.
So how did it grow? What was your first degree?
My first degree was in biology.
Okay.
And so I did work in rainforests as part of that, and that was a real eye-opener. I had grown up in Arizona in the desert, which is a wonderful place, but the contrast to the rainforest blew my mind.
Yes.
The biodiversity, the lushness, just the unusual traits of birds, right? You can just look at birds and be amazed at the birds that are there. And I think that experience really brought home how diverse our world is naturally. And I also had experiences there where I saw deforestation for palm oil plantations. I was able to confront some of those large environmental issues. I was able to see the impacts myself. And that really had an impact on me.
Are we talking South America?
Central America.
Central America, yes. How long were you there for?
I was there for a few months. I was working out of a biological station called La Selva. Yeah, it was a really special experience. Learned a lot.
That must have been quite a culture shock.
Definitely. And I think a culture shock in the sense that not only was it a different country than I was used to, but we were living on the edge of a rainforest.
Beautiful.
And I remember waking up, I would have these vivid dreams where there are these howler monkeys that make this horrible like whooping noise. And I remember I would have these kind of uncharacteristically violent dreams because they would keep waking me up.
That's such an amazing experience to have. And then you came back from Central America. Did you go straight into another degree?
I did. So I went straight through to get my PhD, where I was studying ecology. But I kind of switched environments. So instead of working in the tropics like I had expected, I started a project that was in the Arctic. It was looking at plant-soil relationships in tundra and looking at some of the climate change impacts in the tundra and how those might affect carbon cycling. In tundra and in certain grasslands, we're seeing what folks call woody encroachment, which is basically just woody deciduous shrubs expanding their range. But the Arctic stores a whole lot of carbon, specifically below ground. And so I was interested in how these plants might be interacting with the soil in a different way and how that could change carbon cycling. Low temperatures and slow decomposition are the big ones. And so as plants grow over time, there's not kind of the counterbalance of decomposition like you might find in an environment like in lower BC where we are. So that carbon just accumulates over time and it also freezes. So there's not just the soil that thaws out in the summer, but then there's also the permafrost beneath it that has huge quantities of carbon.
Wow, this is so interesting. They don't teach you this stuff in school. It's very, very interesting. So this tundra, was this in Alaska?
Yeah, I worked in Alaska and Sweden.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think you went to Denmark as well, didn't you? Is that right?
I did. Yeah, that's where I did the work in Sweden. So my research sites were in Sweden, but I was based at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark.
Wow, such a lot of traveling. Now, are you built for cold or are you built for heat? Did you decide?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm built for appropriate clothing. That's what I should say. Yeah, I've been really fortunate in being able to travel so much for my work.
Yes.
And see all these amazing places up close.
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite place that you've been to?
I think my favorite place, especially right now, is wherever my family is. But in terms of an ecosystem, which I think was your question, yeah, the tundra was incredible. I'd never seen anything like it. And I had a realization of what the word awesome actually meant. I'm a millennial, right? So I grew up using awesome really casually. And I remember coming up over a mountain range called the Brooks Range in Alaska, and you could see out just for miles and miles. It was this incredibly clear day. And I thought, wow, this is awesome. And the originally intended definition of the word.
Just being totally in awe of nature.
Exactly.
All its splendor. Yeah, that is such a wonderful thing to be able to do. I always love it when you're in a plane and you're flying over mountains and you can see the geography less. That's the bit that I love. You can see all those little tarns, the way that the glaciers are made, and just amazing to actually be able to experience it. True knowledge is experience.
Agreed.
So you've been to all these wonderful places and then you're back in BC at the university to finish up your PhD?
Just to work. Yeah, so I finished my PhD in 2018 and now I'm here as a researcher in residence. There's a project that's funded by the institute that I work for. And so I'm part of that project trying to understand how we can manage our wildfire problem, and especially in BC and Washington state, how we can reconfigure our forests so that they're more resilient, so that they're able to experience the disturbances, the warmer temperatures, the drought, the fire that we know is coming, but still be able to provide the ecosystem services to our species, as well as all the other species in those ecosystems.
So reconfigure means, what does that mean?
Reconfigure means, like I was talking before, in terms of the patchwork that's gone away from our forest as a result of fire suppression. So thinking about how we can bring that patchwork back and thinking about the tools that are available to us to do that, whether it be prescribed burning, and whether it be selective harvesting to thin out some of the stands that are much more dense than they were previously. So thinking about those kinds of strategies.
And do we have more threats to the trees in terms of those bugs? This is terribly unscientific of me, but I do know there was a beetle, wasn't there? It was causing a whole lot of damage.
Yeah, mountain pine beetle has killed a lot of trees in BC. Yeah, in Jasper, trees turn red at first, and then they turn gray. And so there are these pictures of the road that you take into Jasper where just the mountainside is completely red almost, with lots and lots of beetle-killed trees.
So Carly, you've obviously found your calling. What next? What's your dream?
I don't know, to be honest. I think I'm still in the process of figuring out what that is. I think the pandemic for a lot of folks has been an awakening of sort and a resorting of priorities.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I'm still in the midst of that. I moved to BC from the US during the pandemic in August of 2020. And so I think I'm still trying to figure out what the future holds for me. But I hope to keep working in this space.
Yeah.
In terms of climate solutions, in terms of communicating science to people who aren't scientists.
Would you like to teach?
I did some teaching in graduate school. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I'm not sure it's my calling, but I'd be open to it.
And there's a thin line between what you're doing and politics, basically, isn't there? Because you almost have to know quite a lot about the political situation to know where things might lead.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's a knowledge base I'm working to develop.
The policies change so quickly, right? You have to keep up with that to see what you can do.
Definitely. And I think that it's an interesting line. Like you said, it's a really thin line, but as a scientist, it's an interesting one to toe in terms of maintaining that scientific objectivity when it comes to work and doing the science, but also having the awareness to interpret that science for people who need to understand the implications, in this case, policymakers.
Yeah.
So I'm still learning about how to toe that line.
Yeah, absolutely. I presume at the moment they've obviously got a few more things on their mind, but how do you see the information getting out to the general public? I mean, everybody's told when it goes to fossil fuel emissions, turn the light off and don't drive too far and try and get an electric car and all that stuff. But do you think really the gravity of it is totally understood?
Not really, to be honest. No, not really. But I'm not sure I totally understand the gravity of it either. When the pandemic started, I found a text message that I had sent to a friend that said, wow, this is going to be a weird few weeks. I'm not an epidemiologist, right? So I have no qualifications to make any sort of claims about how the pandemic was going to play out. But I think there's still that almost a hopefulness that I've tried to hold on to that I think is perhaps keeping me from understanding or fully describing how negative climate change would be, right? I know my piece of it. I know what's happening with wildfires and what's projected to keep happening with wildfires. But beyond that, I'm aware of the dangers of sea level rise and the importance of adapting to climate change. But I'm not sure I've totally grappled with what that means.
How do you go about projecting what it might be?
Of models. I'm not a climate modeler myself, but there are lots of folks who've dedicated their life to that, who have developed and tweaked and improved climate models that help us understand what it's going to look like in the future.
This is such a new area for me. I'm asking very simple questions, but it's very, very interesting. I love the idea of the work that you're doing, taking us back to the patchwork model that used to work in the past.
Yeah, there's a scientist I work with named Paul Hesburgh, who's a research scientist at the U.S. Forest Service. And that is his life's work. He actually did a TED Talk all about that forest patchiness a few years ago in Oregon. That's excellent. And I find his work really inspiring.
Wonderful. And your TED Talk, of course, we're here because of the TED Talk. How was that for you? That was a challenge in itself, wasn't it?
It was. I'd be interested to know what your experiences were like, too. So it was interesting. I'd never done anything like it before. And so I learned a lot. And I think what I especially appreciated was the consistent feedback throughout the process, which really helped me because similar to all the speakers, you're a subject matter expert in that specific slice of the world that you're trying to share with other people. And so I really appreciated the opportunity to learn what wasn't clear that I was saying, what folks weren't connecting with in terms of the points I was making. And so that was incredibly valuable. But it was also very intimidating, especially to be on a stage in an almost empty room without the pressure of a crowd.
I know. But without the feedback of a crowd either. That often helps.
Exactly. Right. That kind of positive reinforcement and the energy of just I'm engaged with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was also missing. What was your experience like, Sue?
Well, number one, I had no idea how incredibly well organized it would be. I just foolishly thought that people got up on a stage and they spoke from their heart and the message went out and that was it. In 2010, I volunteered for the Olympics here in Vancouver and the same thing happened to me. I was so incredibly blown away by the organization in terms of the training and the clothing and all that. And it was very much like that for the TED Talk because as soon as you were in the system, you knew what you were going to do the next week and the next 2 weeks. And every time I had a question, they automatically answered it. When we had our next Zoom call, that blew me away. In terms of the coaching, I had no idea that it could be so professional, number one, and so thorough. And we had coaches for everything, didn't we? We had a beginning and an end coach and a theme coach and a core message coach and everything was taken care of.
I tried on my outfits for Vindi on Zoom.
That's hilarious.
I asked her for feedback even on that aspect.
I was terrified when I got up on the stage. And the thing is, you know your talk, you know it inside out, you've been rehearsing it, you've memorized it, you wake up in the morning thinking it, but you cannot prepare for the feeling that comes up inside of you when you actually step on that dot. You can't practice that.
I totally agree.
And I can hear it in my voice in the recording. I can hear the sort of waver. At the same time, I would do it all again because I felt very much taken care of.
And it was really nice to feel part of a larger community, I think, especially right now. And I really appreciated that everybody on the team bought into that.
Yes.
There wasn't resistance to that kind of community built idea. And I really appreciated being able to be part of that.
Yeah. And it seems like we're never going to be away from it in a way, because one of our practices was with past speakers, wasn't it? So I'm presuming that next year when they have a practice, we might be called upon to listen to their speeches.
Yeah, I would hope so. I would love to be able to provide that for other folks in the way they did for us.
So Carly, what would you like to leave our listeners with? How can we help? What do we have to do now? What's your call to arms?
I think my call to arms is to vote, to get involved in the political system and understand that science is not separate from politics, like you alluded to before. Perhaps it's my own naivete, but I know I went to school with a lot of people who saw politics and science as separate, and I don't think that's the case anymore. And so, yes, I would encourage people to vote and to get involved in the climate movement.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you, Carly, very, very much for joining us.
It's been so lovely chatting with you, Sue.
Well, thank you. I'm really enjoying covering more about all of the speakers. So thank you for joining us. How can we get in touch with you?
I don't have social media, but I do have email, so folks can reach out to me there. I can be reached at Carly Phillips, my full name, at uvic.ca. I would love to hear from folks. I work for the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, and you can find their website at pics.uvic.ca.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. This is really interesting and really important and very current. Thank you to everyone who's listening. Please subscribe, follow, share, and if you'd like to see what the whole Dyslexic Society is up to, go to www.thewds.org, and we'd love to hear from you at info@thewds.org. I hope you'll join us to hear some more of our speakers and more of the TEDx Bear Creek Park organizing and coaching team. So until next time, take care, stay well, and bye for now.